You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Communications Workers Local 6360 and International Association of Firefighters Local 42. The Communications Workers of America Local 6360 represents workers at AT&T, Lantel Communications, Rogers Printing, E2 Embroidery, Mood Media, and 911 dispatchers for the City of Independence in Jackson County. We work every day to protect workers' rights. Buying union-made products helps us all keep good jobs. And brought to you by the Greater Kansas City Firefighters IAFF Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, International Association of Firefighters representing fire, EMS, and public safety professionals, serving you since 1918. Local 42 advocates continuously for the public good, and we depend on you to help us defend the rights of our diverse membership of men and women. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we discuss Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, Without a Home, Everything Else Falls Apart. Then, why did Mexican police fire on unarmed teachers and community members in June, killing 9 people? Leaders of the Mexican Teachers Union remain in jail for protesting the corporate takeover of education. In the news, guess what state pays its public employees the worst? And will there be a prisoner's strike tomorrow? Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Ekel. Now for the news.
The news from our side, September 8, 2016. Guess which state pays its public workers the least in the nation? You might think it's Kansas with all their budget problems, but no, Kansas ranks 21st in pay. You'd be right if you said Missouri. Its average pay is $39,682 a year. That's average. A starting corrections officer could make as little as $28,260. Whereas Illinois pays its trainees $42,432. The 25-page study was released in July and was researched by St. Louis-based CBIZ Human Capital Services. It cost the state $324,000. It concluded that low pay leads to high turnover rates in many state jobs. That costs taxpayers additional money in overtime and training. In some departments, turnover is enormous, 25.7% in 2014 in Missouri's Department of Mental Health, and 16.3% in the state's largest agency, the Department of Corrections. The report estimates it would take $13 million to boost pay just for the 5,050 workers earning below what workers in similar jobs making other states and private industry. On Wednesday, a joint House and Senate committee reviewed the study. Senator Kiki Curls of Kansas City told the Post in St. Louis, "The fact that Missouri ranks 50th is not something I'm very proud of." The chairman of the committee, Representative Mike Birx-Schoeder of Jeff City, who represents many of the low-paid workers, said he hopes the panel can meet again in January to begin implementing some of the recommended changes. It seems like it's doable, in the budget, he said.
The Nation reports that on September 9th, potentially thousands of inmates across both state and federal prisons in as many as 24 states plan to engage in a coordinated strike and protest in order to call attention to the daily injustice of their lives. The strikers are calling for an end to slave-like working conditions, illegal reprisals, and inhumane living conditions. Planned for the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising, the actions of September 9 will shed light on the often decrepit conditions suffered by the 2.4 million people in what is the largest prison system in the world. This movement has been building for at least a decade. This year has brought a wave of new strikes, starting with inmates in seven Texas state prisons striking in April. Alabama inmates engaged in a work strike and protest in May, and since then there have been work strikes and hunger strikes in Mississippi, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, Nevada, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania. The list of grievances and demands for tomorrow's strike is long. In Texas, it's the deadly heat, with most facilities lacking air conditioning, and heat indexes reportedly rising into the 150 Fahrenheit in some units. Inmates in Wisconsin and Ohio are protesting the excessive use of solitary confinement. Others complain of rotten food and contaminated water. There is a revolting green hamburger video online from Alabama. But the biggest issue is prison labor. Across the U.S., there are nearly 900,000 inmates who currently work in prisons. In states such as Colorado, Arizona, inmates earn as little as a few cents per hour for their work. In Texas, Alabama, Georgia, and Arkansas, incarcerated people are forced to work for free. Prison wages, if paid at all, rarely surpass $4.73 an hour. The minimum wage law doesn't apply because prison administrators claim that inmates are not technically employees. Of course, slavery is unconstitutional, but there's an exception for prisoners. Conditions in prison fields and factories are harsh, and inmates complain of abuse, denial of adequate food, and no protection from heat. If they protest, they are brutalized. Organizing within prisons is very difficult, but it's happening, and outside groups like the anarchist Black Cross and Free State movements, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and their Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, the IWOC, are all helping. An inmate-led group called FAM has spearheaded the agitation behind the strike. Last year, they were first to send out a call to action, "Let the crops rot in the fields," which set the emphatically political tone for the September action. While FAM is working closely with IWOC, FAM spokesperson Pastor Kenneth Sharpton Glasgow said FAM had a more radical stance in that it did not want to unionize prison labor, but to abolish it.
Al Jazeera reported last week that tens of millions of Indian public sector workers went on a one-day strike last Friday, September 2nd. Across the country, protesting against Prime Minister Narendra Modi's economic policies, particularly his plans to push for greater privatization. Thousands of state-run banks, government offices, and factories were closed, and public transport disrupted in the strike called by 10 trade unions. T. Raman Pandey of the Indian National Trade Union Congress said, "This strike is against the central government. This strike is for the cause of the working people. Our strike will be 100% successful. We will prove that this strike is the world's largest ever." Union officials said about 180 million workers, including state bank employees, school teachers, postal workers, miners, and construction workers, were participating, but the figure could not be independently verified. Workers are demanding that the government dump plans to close unproductive factories. The strike was called after talks with Finance Minister Arun Jaitley broke down, with union leaders rejecting his offer to raise the minimum wage for unskilled workers from $96 a month to $136. The union said the government should guarantee both Social Security and health care for all, and should be hiking the minimum wage to double what it is offering in order to keep up with inflation. More than 20 protesters were arrested after they damaged two government buses in West Bengal. The Bharatiya Janata Party, led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, won a landslide victory in May 2014 general elections, promising business-friendly reforms to boost the economy. According to the latest budget, the government aims to raise about $8.3 billion through privatization in 2016 and 17 and shut down some state-run firms after losses exceeding $4 billion in the last financial year.
A new study from the Economic Policy Institute calculates the cost of the loss of manufacturing jobs and union busing to American workers' incomes over the last 35 years. An article in American Prospect sums it up. Since 1979, the share of men belonging to unions in private sector workforce has fallen from 34% to 10%. If unions had the same presence in the private sector today as they did in 1979, men, both union members and non-union members alike, would be making $2,704 more each year. The EPI researchers also found that union membership makes a tremendous difference for people who do not have college degrees. Real wages for non-union men without college degrees are even lower today than they were in the 70s. The report noted that for women, the effects of union decline on wages of non-union women are not as substantial because women are not as unionized as men were in 1979, so it's hard to compare. Jake Rosenfield of Washington University in St. Louis report. The report's co-author says there are multiple reasons for this. The loss of traditional union manufacturing jobs to global offshoring is one, but you can't overlook the role of employer opposition in that decline, especially as organized labor tries to broaden its reach to other sectors like the service industry. He says it became part and parcel to the way of doing business started in the 70s and 80s. Employers got organized and became incredibly effective at using the regulations to rid themselves of existing unions and preventing new unions from coming in. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Judy Ansel, and myself, Michael Savoy.
This is Molly Madden, and you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. The author of tonight's book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, is Dr. Matthew Desmond, an American sociologist and urban ethnographer. Dr. Matthew Desmond spoke at a panel discussion at the Malcolm Weiner Center for Social Policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Matthew Desmond is a John L. Loeb Associate Professor of Social Science at Harvard and a MacArthur Scholar.
This book is based on ethnographic fieldwork that I started in 2008, began living with evicted tenants and their landlords in poor Milwaukee neighborhoods where I live. It also reports findings from analysis of hundreds and thousands of eviction records, of millions of 911 calls, of original surveys, including a survey of over 1,000 renters in the city. And the multiple methods that the book draws upon talk to each other, and they inform each other in different ways, and each keeps the other honest. Evicted follows eight families, some black, some white, some have children, some don't, swept up in the process of eviction. We meet Lorraine, who's a grandmother at a trailer park, who has to decide between paying her rent and paying the gas bill because she wants to take a hot shower. We meet Lamar, who's this gregarious, amazing, complex, wheelchair-bound father, single dad, who tries to work off the rent by performing on jobs for his landlord. I can't tell you all these stories tonight, but I'm going to tell you one. I'm going to tell you Arlene's story. So it had been a difficult year ever since that snowball. Jory and his cousin had been cutting up, packing snow hard and letting it fly at these cars. And Jory got this really good snowball and smacked this car. And this man jumped out. and Jory and his cousin ran inside, and the man followed them there and kicked in the door and left before anything else happened. And the landlord, when she found out about that, evicted Jory's mom, Arlene, and Jory and his younger brother for damaging her property, and Arlene cussed Jory because she couldn't cuss the landlord. So Arlene took her two sons, Jory was 14 at the time, DeForest was 6, to the Salvation Army homeless shelter, which everyone calls the Lodge, so you can tell your kids, we're staying at the Lodge tonight, like it's a hotel. And from there, she started looking for another house, and she found one on 19th Street. There often was no water, and Jory had to bucket out what was in the toilet. It was quiet, Arlene remembered, and 525 for a whole house is my favorite place. When we looked at survey data of renters in the city, we found that those whose previous move was an eviction, those are the red bars, they were 25% more likely to live in housing with serious, severe housing problems. If we want to know why some poor families live in much worse housing than others, which we know really damages kids' health, one of the reasons is they're forced to accept this housing in the harried aftermath of an eviction. So the city eventually found Arlene's favorite place unfit for human habitation, and hard-headed men drilled green boards over the windows and the doors. Arlene was again on the hunt for another house, and she told Jory, we take whatever we can get, and that's what neighborhood and housing selection looks like at the very bottom, just taking whatever you can get. A drab apartment complex on Atkinson Avenue was what Arlene got. But she soon found out it was a haven for drug dealers. The whole block was drug-soaked. And she feared for her boys, especially Jory, who was goofy and had this beautiful smile and would talk to anyone. So for Arlene, why she moved was a decisive factor in explaining why she ended up in such a distressed neighborhood. And you can see this pattern in the survey data as well. Experiencing eviction is associated with about a third standard deviation increase in neighborhood poverty rate relative to voluntary movers, which means families involuntarily displaced from their homes, those blue bars, they end up in worse neighborhoods than similar families that move under less harrowing circumstances. So Arlene moved away from Atkinson Avenue as fast as she could. She found a two-bedroom apartment duplex on 13th Street. There's a fist-sized hole in the living room window. The front door had to be locked with this ugly wooden plank. The carpet was filthy and ground into the floor. But she put on a good face. She stuffed a piece of cloth into the window hole, and she hung ivory curtains. The rent was $550 a month, utilities not included, which at that time was the going rate for a two-bedroom apartment in one of the worst neighborhoods in the fourth poorest city in the nation. That rent took 88% of Arlene's welfare check. Arlene is not alone in spending the majority of her income on housing. For almost a century, there's been a broad consensus in America that we should spend about 30% of our income on housing, so we have enough left over to buy food, for transportation, start mild savings accounts. But the percentage of poor renting families meeting that ideal has steadily declined over the years, to the point that today, over half of all poor renting families in America are spending at least half of their income on housing costs, and about one in four are dedicating 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. And so under those conditions, for people like Arlene, eviction isn't the result of an irresponsibility as much as a result of inevitability. In the 2000s, housing costs soared all around the country while incomes at the bottom were stagnant. And if you compare the median gross rent and median renter income, the relationship looks like this. But I still think most Americans, when you ask them where the typical low-income family lives, they still picture public housing or think that most low-income Americans benefit in some way from government assistance. But the opposite is true. Only about one in four households who qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive it. And that arrangement would be unthinkable with other social services that cover basic necessities. Imagine if three in four people that applied for food stamps were turned away hungry. But that's exactly how we treat housing in this country. In our nation's capital, the waiting list for public housing is not counted in years. It's counted in decades, which means that if you're a young parent and you apply for public housing today, you might be a grandparent by the time your application comes up. On 13th Street, Arlene found like a bucket of paint and rollers in the basement, and she started painting the walls, gave it a fresh coat. But not long after moving in, her sister died. Not her sister in the biological sense, but in the spiritual sense. Friends, they're close. And she helped pay for the funeral costs. She didn't have the money, but no one else did either, and she felt that it was her obligation. She would have been ashamed of herself if she didn't. The next month, an appointment with their welfare caseworker came up, but Arlene missed it because the letter announcing the appointment was mailed to 19th Street or maybe Atkinson Avenue. Her caseworker typed something into the computer and her $628 a month check was cut. So 2 months behind, Arlene got the pink papers, an eviction summons and complaint. Milwaukee's a city of about 105,000 renter-occupied households. And in that city alone, landlords evict roughly 16,000 adults and kids every year. That's about 40 people evicted every day in the city of Milwaukee, including days like today where it's very cold outside. These numbers up on the screen only count formal court-ordered evictions, but there are other ways, cheaper and quicker ways, for a landlord to displace a family. So I met a landlord that will pay you $200 and let you use his van if you're out by Sunday. I met a landlord that will take your door off. We worked really hard to capture all those things in the survey. And if you count all those informal evictions that don't go through the court, the formal evictions that do, if you count landlord foreclosures and building condemnations, you learn that every 2 years, one in eight renters in the city of Milwaukee is evicted. That's an incredible, staggering number. The numbers are similar in other cities that I've looked at, Kansas City, Cleveland, Chicago. And according to the most recent data from the American Housing Survey, renters in over 2.8 million households in the U.S. thought that they would be evicted soon. Eviction affects the old and the young. It affects the sick and the able-bodied. But the face of America's eviction epidemic belongs to moms and kids. Walking about any urban housing court in the country, you can see for yourself what eviction looks like. It's kids and moms sitting rows after rows after rows. Poor African-American mothers like Arlene, women in generally, are evicted at especially high rates. In Milwaukee, among renters, one in five black women report being evicted sometime in their lifetime, compared to one in 15 white women. If incarceration has come to define the lives of low-income men from poor African-American communities, eviction is defining the lives of women in those communities. In eviction court, the commissioner, as is court custom, gave Arlene 2 extra days in the apartment for each of her 2 boys. Those days came and went, and Arlene had to be out in a day in January. It was freezing. The Milwaukee weathermen had been working themselves up. They said it was going to be the coldest day in a decade, so the temperature can bottom out at 40 below wind chill. But if Arlene waited any longer, her landlord would call the sheriff, who days later would arrive with a badge and a gun and a team of movers and pile all her things on the sidewalk, the mattresses, the meat cuts in the freezer, Jafaris's asthma machine. So in the cold, Arlene left to a homeless shelter and again began looking for housing. And she applied for 20 apartments, and then 40, and then 60, and then 80. I counted. Even in the inner city, many were out of reach, and landlords of the places that she could afford if she threw almost everything she had at the rent weren't calling back. And part of the reason, besides her poverty, was her eviction record, which followed her around. Many landlords reject anyone with a recent eviction, pushing evicted families into bad neighborhoods and bad housing. But finally, Mr. 90, the 90th landlord she called, said yes. He had a one-bedroom apartment. It was 525. Arlene much didn't consider the neighborhood, the conditions of the place. A house is a house, she told Joy. So 2 months after her eviction court hearing, Arlene moved into her new place. She liked it. All the cupboards had handles. All the lights had fixtures. And once all the trash bags of clothes and the boxes of canned food were kind of in the house removed, she just like sat on the floor and she found this trash bag with it, that had towels in it, and she leaned against it. And Jory came and kind of pitched his head against her shoulder. And Jafaris, 6-year-old, came and laid his head on her lap. And they just stayed like that for a long time. Arlene got her stuff out of storage. She hung pictures on the wall. She liked things neat. So she hung a sign over the kitchen that said, "Joy, if you don't clean up after yourself, we're going to have problems." But shortly after they moved in, Joy began acting out at school. It's hard to be 14. It's hard to be 14 and homeless and bounce from school to school to school. And after a teacher yelled at Joy one day, he kicked her in the shin and ran home. And instead of calling the principal, the teacher called the police. And when the landlord found out that the police had come, he told Arlene that they had to leave. She was beginning to unravel. "It's like I got a curse on me," she told me. "It won't stop for nothing. Sometimes I find my body trembling or shaking. I'm tired, but I can't sleep. I'm fixing to have a nervous breakdown. My body is trying to shut down." I recently published a study that found that mothers experience higher levels of depressive symptoms 2 years after they've been evicted. And we know that between 2005 and 2010, the number of suicides attributed to evictions and foreclosures doubled. The same years that housing costs across the country were skyrocketing. "Just my soul is messed up," Arlene told me. "I wish my life were different. I wish that I'd be an old lady and I sit back and look at my kids and they'd be grown and they, you know, become something and we'll all be together and be laughing. We'll be remembering stuff like this. We'll be laughing at it." The home is like the center of life. It's our refuge from work and the menace of the streets. In languages spoken all over the world, the word for home encompasses not just shelter, but warmth and family and safety in the womb. Evictions, which used to be rare enough to draw crowds, erases the home, and it's causing not poverty. It's not just a condition of it. It's a cause of it. We can't fix poverty in this country without fixing housing. So how do we fix it? I think the answer to that question depends on us answering another one, which is, do we believe that housing is a fundamental right? Do we believe that part of what it means to be an American is to live in decent, affordable housing in this country? And I think we have to say yes. And the reason is simple. Without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. And I think the best way to deliver on that obligation is a universal housing program. What about expanding vouchers to every single family below a certain income level? That family would dedicate 30% of their income to rent, housing costs, the voucher would cover the rest. They could take that voucher and live anywhere they wanted as long as their housing wasn't too expensive or too shoddy. It would fundamentally change the face of poverty in this country. When families finally receive a voucher after years and years on the waiting list, they do one consistent thing. They go to the grocery store and they buy more food and their kids become stronger and less anemic. But kids for most low-income renting families today aren't getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. And I think that a national affordable housing program would be an amazing anti-poverty effort, a human capital investment, a community involvement plan, and a public health initiative all rolled into one. Or let's do something else, you know? Cities are different. One city has to build, one city has to tear down. What works in Boston might not work in Milwaukee. Let's have the conversation. But I think that whatever our way out of this mess, whatever our solution, one thing is certain, like this degree of inequality, this cold denial of basic rights, this blunting of human capacity, there's no way we can justify this. There's no American value, no ethical teaching, no piece of scripture that can be summoned to allow us to defend what some places in our country have become. Thanks.
Dr. Desmond did this project in Milwaukee, but in Kansas City, Jackson County, they saw 19 formal evictions a day between 2009 and 2015. Formal means that they take them to court. There are lots of informal evictions, so we really don't know the total number. And I'd like to let the audience know that this book was such an easy read because all the stories were at the beginning, the stories of all the his life in the trailer park and his life in the inner city with these folks. And then all the dry things like the surveys and that the University of Wisconsin students did to make sure that just this wasn't an aberration, these weren't just a few people. They did surveys to make sure that everybody knew exactly how bad evictions were in Milwaukee. So I would recommend this as an easy read. You'd maybe take a weekend to read it, really. It's not dry at all, except at the end, when you have to read all the stats. And I thank Dr. Desmond for all his work. Thank you.
Remittances back home from primarily low-wage immigrants sustain families, communities, and countries. Money flows. On Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Support for KKFI provided by the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus, presenting the 25th Annual Torch Dinner on Friday, September 16th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Boulevard Brewery, 2501 Southwest Boulevard, KCMO. Festivities include honoring this year's award recipients, cocktails, silent auction, and dinner. Reservations deadline, September 9. Details and reservations at gkcwkc.org.
In May, teachers in the Mexican state of Oaxaca started blocking this major highway. The protesters are part of the radical wing of the teachers union and are fighting against reforms that they say unfairly blame teachers for the country's poor education record. The reforms were actually passed years ago, but the recent arrest of two protest leaders has sparked violent clashes. Last month, the police used live ammunition to clear the road, leaving at least 9 people dead and dozens injured. In spite of this, the teachers and their supporters are maintaining the blockade.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
You just heard an excerpt from Vice News from July 7th, 2016, and you were just listening to Pete Seeger's What I Learned in School Today. Welcome tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Christina Hendricks.
And I'm Chris Mann.
Our topic tonight on Heartland Labor Forum, we will be talking about teachers across Mexico fighting back against regressive educational reform that has been long in the making. We will be talking to Manuel Rodriguez, an assistant principal and activist from Chihuahua City, Mexico. Here, he will shine light on how Mexico is rising up to these newest reforms.
Yes, my name is Noel Garcia,
and
I'm from Chihuahua, Mexico.
Okay, and you are a secondary education teacher.
Yes, I'm a secondary school teacher. I'm an assistant principal at a secondary school here in Chihuahua City.
Okay. And, Noel, how widespread is the teachers' movement in Mexico at this time?
We teachers have been protesting against our education reform in most of the states in Mexico. The protests are very, very widespread across the country. You know, there are some states where the fight is, the struggle is stronger, and most of the teachers and many other community members participate in protests. But in 29 of the 32 entities or states of Mexico, in 29 we had protests in different grades of development. But we are protesting.
And what about the education reform? What are the principles that are so harmful to teachers?
The so-called education reform deprives teachers of our fundamental rights at work. And it seriously impairs the right to education of children and youth. In February 2013, two articles of our federal constitution were amended to tie job security to evaluations under a regime of standardized tests. In September of the same year, secondary reform laws were passed. Education reform was driven by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also by the greatest Mexican businessman and mainstream media. But teachers, parents, students, experts, and researchers in education were never heard. The new provisions deprive teachers of our basic labor rights established in the Constitution since long time ago, such as the job certainty and the rights to free association and collective bargaining. These rights are also protected in various international instruments that the Mexican government is committed to fulfill. The reform decree also establishes the autonomy of school management, which actually means here in our Mexico that the government gets rid of its obligation to meet the material needs of schools and passes his responsibility to school communities, and more specifically, to the families of the students. While millions of families across the country do not have money to meet even their most basic needs, such as food, medical care, housing, clothing. That's why teachers have been protesting across many states since that reform was passed. And in recent months, the teachers' protests have become a major social movement, as too many parents of our students and townspeople have joined, especially in states and regions with lower incomes, because they also suffer from the imposition of government policies that take away their natural resources and their basic human rights. There is a growing anger of teachers and many other poor people against a government that refuses to really listen and respond to our demands and respect our resources and our fundamental rights.
So then that led to a teacher's strike earlier this year?
Yes. In some states, there is a strike, an indefinite strike since May 15th.
Mm-hmm.
In other states, we protest different days, but we are not left the schools.
The protest on June 19th, what was unusual about that? It seemed...
There are several events which led to that protest. Number one, the persistent denial of a government to discuss education reform with teachers. Since June 2015, the government had refused to dialogue, saying they would only talk to teachers if teachers accepted the reform, while the abrogation of the reform is the central demand of our struggle. Number two, the dismissal of thousands of teachers across the country that were not submitted to the assessment imposed by the government through threats, intimidation, and the use of police force. Let me tell you that in some states, armed policemen took teachers in police vehicles from the hotels where they had been previously confined to the places of application of examinations. One more reason is that the suspension of payments to thousands of teachers without warning and without prior resolution of any administrative disciplinary proceedings. I mean, that suspension of payments brought too much anger among teachers. One more reason is the illegal intervention of the bank accounts of the union sections of Oaxaca and Chiapas, where leaders have the legal representation of teachers, and therefore they manage dues. One more cause is that the police goes to each of the public protests and intimidates and beats demonstrators and tries to prevent our rights of transit and demonstration. One more reason, and maybe the one which led to a different kind of protest, is the imprisonment of the leaders of the teachers, especially in the state of Oaxaca, where the main leaders of Section 22 of the union were arrested with excessive violence as if they were dangerous criminals. Some of these political prisoners were sent to federal prisons too far from their places of residence, which complicates the legal defense and that their relatives can visit them. All those reasons led to a higher level of protests, including blockades of roads, railroads, and some other actions which sometimes bother or cause some damage to people outside the conflict. Mm-hmm. But we understand, and we have said it, that the government is the main responsible for that long time that the conflict has lasted, and his negative to answer our demands, to respond to our petitions.
So what about the arrests of the union leaders? Have they been released?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. You know, look, we have 40 political prisoners. Let me check the numbers. For the day of the events in Nochixtlán, June 19th, there were 40 people detained for protests against education reform. After a month and a half that began negotiations with the government, only 8 of them have been released, including the two main leaders of Section 22 of the union in Oaxaca, who were released just this morning. But we have still 32 political prisoners detained after a month and a half that we have been talking with the government.
So have the protests continued while the talks are going on?
After what happened in Nochixtlán on June 22nd, the government accepted to dialogue with teachers and additionally with the authorities and some other representatives of Nochixtlán, of the communities around Nochixtlán. But there are no results. There are no results from that dialogue. No blame person about Nochixtlán. No person has been prosecuted for the killings of 11 people, and nor for the dozens of wounded. Nothing. Medical care that has been provided to the injured is very far from enough and very time-consuming. There is no damage repair at all.
Have other
regarding our demands, the demands of teachers, we have not seen significant progress. The government is committed to holding negotiations, but it does not fulfill the agreements and only manages the conflict.
Have other unions joined your fight?
There is a main national union in Mexico, Union of Teachers, which is called Sindicato Nacional de Trabajadores de la Educación, CENTE, with S, S-N-T-E. And we, the teachers who are protesting, belong to a segment of that union, which is the Coordinator, National Workers, Education Workers Coordinator, the CENTE with C. We are majority, but they, the CENTE with S, they have the support of the government. And they were They have been for the most of the time since 2013 when the reform was passed until 2 weeks ago. They were with the government in the imposition of the reform. But now, when the huge mobilization of people around across the country has obligated the government to negotiate, the same government brought his muchachos, his boys, to give them some answers, some responses to our demands. The government uses the former leaders of the union to try to stop the protest and to try to go free with their politics, with their policies, because the former leaders are allies too with the government. And there are some other small unions in some states, but they have few members. The main union is the CENTE, and the main organization of the protest is around the Coordinadora, as we call it.
Mm-hmm. So do you have hope that this will change?
Education Workers Coordinator.
Yeah. Are you hopeful that things will change?
Yes. I'm hopeful. I'm sure that we are going to win, because too many people in this country have realized that we have to change things here, not only in education. Our government is taking part with the richest people in our country, and they have been passing reforms and approving projects that damage our people, the poor people in many states, in many regions of our country. And people is getting tired of that. So nowadays, no one intellectual, no one researcher or expert in education here in Mexico talks or speaks well about that so-called education reform.
I see.
The government has, at this moment, the force of the police, and not more.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And we're almost out of time. What can our listeners here in Kansas City do?
They're in the United States.
Yes, in the United States. What can people in the United States do?
They can send letters to the Mexican consulate in their cities. They can also organize actions to express solidarity in their cities and share about them. They can give some financial contributions to a bank account that we can later give to you to share. And, of course, they will help if they disseminate information shared by teachers and people who support the struggle.
We want to thank you so much.
I thank to you very much. I appreciate you have your disposition to let our voice be heard in the United States. Thank you very much, Christina.
And thank you.
As we bring this show to a close, we would like to remind our listeners that education is a right for all and the foundation to our society. When voices are ignored, the people rise up. Undoubtedly, these teachers are showing their students what it means to take a stand and what it means to be active in your community. While the U.S. and Mexico seem to be two completely different cultures, at the same time, we can see that we carry some of the same struggles and have the same passion for change. That is why the North American teachers should join together to fight for public education. Thank you for listening.
from yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach.
Hold it. No, listen. You can't clap if you can't carry the beat, so you gotta not clap, okay?
Well, that was Teach Your Children Well, but not exactly the version I thought. This is Judy Ansel. And Arianna Eagle couldn't make it tonight for her Remember Our Struggle. And so I'm going to talk about something else. I'm director of the Worker Education and Labor Studies program at UMKC. And yesterday, senatorial candidate Jason Kander came to UMKC to talk to students and administrators and me about college affordability. And I thought I'd read what I had to say to him about college affordability. The decline in college affordability has lots of ramifications for our students, keeping some from going to college at all and others with debts that last a lifetime. My program, the Worker Education Labor Studies program, was designed to be continuing education for union members, but UMKC long ago priced itself out of that market. So we depend on regular degree-seeking students who would like a career fighting for social justice. Not a very lucrative career, however, especially if you must go into debt in order to pay for it. One of the things that has changed most in my almost 30 years here at UMKC is the increasing number of students who must work full-time in order to pay for college. The stress I hear in their voices when they miss class or are late with assignments is evident. My hours were changed, or I got called into work because another worker is sick and I can't say no, are frequent excuses. Some fall asleep in class, others are evidently permanently sleep deprived. So I thought I'd look into how much you have to work to pay for college these days, as opposed to, say, 1980, which was the farthest back I could find tuition figures from the Department of Education. I decided to use minimum wage, since many college students find jobs that pay at or near it, and I adjusted the figures for inflation, as tuition in $1980 dollars is not comparable to $2015 dollars, and the minimum wage bought so much more in 1980. Here's what I found. In 1980, tuition at UMKC was $856 for a year. In today's dollars, that would be $2,462. Tuition last year at UMKC was $9,553. That's almost four times higher. The minimum wage in 1980 was $3.10 an hour, worth $8.92 in today's dollars. Taking the Missouri minimum wage of $7.65 today, we can see that it's actually dropped by 14% in its value. So, what does that mean for how many weeks you need to work in order to pay just your tuition and fees? We're not talking about books or living expenses or transportation here, just tuition. In 1980, a student had to work full-time a little less than 7 weeks to earn enough to pay for his or her tuition. That's at the minimum wage. You could do that in the summer. But by 2015, you had to work a little over 31 weeks. That's about 4.5 times as much as you had to work in 1980. Again, not counting how much you have to work to pay for living expenses and books. And of course, it's really hard to work full-time and go to school full-time, so most students don't and find themselves working all year just to pay for the inflated cost of their education. There's two obvious reasons for this, and probably a few more. One is the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation. If it had, it would be closer to $11. Still, not enough, but better. The second reason is that our state legislators have abandoned a commitment to higher education and have year after year cut the amount of appropriations to our public institutions of higher ed. Expenditures in Missouri to the University of Missouri system have dropped 7% since 2002, even though enrollments have gone up. And if you figure it by the number of students, they've dropped 18.5% just since 2008. You're working harder and finding college less affordable because they would rather not tax their rich friends or raise the minimum wage. They care little about that thousands of working-class students in our state can no longer go to college. If you're lucky enough to get scholarships or have parents to help, most of you still have to work. As a teacher, I find this to be a betrayal of our commitment to equal opportunity for all and a total lack of respect for education and the idea of an educated citizenry. That's it. Now for our calendar.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for September 8, 2016. AFL-CIO election kickoff, Saturday, September 10th, 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at 6415 Universal Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri, 64120. Join our other members and working class Missourians who are going to go door to door and talk with neighbors about electing good people for the Senate and, I imagine, Congress. Shut down the Capitol. Take the moral high ground. Join fast food workers and allies to tell lawmakers to raise the minimum wage and stop messing with the voting rights. Monday, September 12th, buses leave Kansas City at 7:30 a.m. and return 5:30 p.m. Buses leave from St. Mark's Lutheran Church at 3800 Troost. To reserve a space on the bus, email info@standupkc.org. Red and Roses Rally and Concert, Saturday, September 17th, 3 p.m., Capitol Steps, Topeka. Sponsored by the BCTGM 218, representing Frito-Lay workers. Focus on how labor contributes and shapes communities we live in.
And that's it for the calendar. You can find our calendar at our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be The Voting Rights Initiative, that's Amendment 6, and Will the Real Jesse James Please Stand Up? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.